That means Russia slams the European signatories to the JCPOA for their unconstructive approach and opposes any proposals that would go beyond the framework of the accord. Tensions running high between the EU and Russia, with the bloc threatening Moscow with unprecedented measures over developments near the Ukrainian border. And inflation in the UK at its highest for over a decade, adding pressure on the Bank of England out of a decision on interest rates. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. Moscow says the stances of the European parties to the 2015 deal with Iran and the ongoing Vienna talks are surprising, unconstructive, and somewhat illogical, as if they were sitting at a negotiating table for the first time. Russia's representative to Vienna-based international organizations, Mikhail Ulyanov, has made the remarks in an interview with Iran's Russian language parts today. He believes that the Vienna talks are moving ahead slowly with high chances of having a positive outcome. The Russian representative said the Iranian delegation is very serious, with clear demands. He also praised Iran's draft proposals as a step forward. Ulyanov said Moscow is opposed to any proposals that would go beyond the framework of the 2015 deal. According to Ulyanov, there are major obstacles to getting a guarantee from the U.S. that it won't withdraw from the deal again. Journalist and political analyst Abbas Aslani says, what the Western parties to the 2015 deal want is to give less to Tehran and get more from it. Take a listen.
Well, it seems the excessive demands by the Europeans as well as the United States in Vienna talks are in a way that even the other parties in the 4+1 are protesting against those demands. They disregard the Iranian concerns when it comes to the benefiting from the lifting of the sanctions. And if that is the case, I think there will be no success in the talks. There needs to be a balance in the demands or the approaches in the negotiations. And the Europeans, as well as the United States, want to put the pressure of time, as well as, the IAEA-related issues on Iranian delegation in order to get more compromises, meaning that they want to give less to Iran but to gain more from the country. And this will not be a balance that can contribute to the restoration of the JCPOA, as well as that will also be detrimental to the durability of the 2015 nuclear agreement.
A top UN official calls on the United States to lift sanctions on Iran and extend waivers regarding oil trade with the country amid the Vienna talks to revitalize the 2015 deal. UN Undersecretary General Rosemary DiCarlo also called for waiver extensions to transfer enriched uranium out of the country in exchange for natural uranium. She said reaching an agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks is the only option for the full and effective implementation of the JCPOA and Resolution 2231 that endorsed it. DiCarlo was briefing the Security Council on the implementation of the resolution. Speaking at the same session, Iran's UN Ambassador Majid Takht-Ravanchi explained Iran's stance on the revival of the 2015 accord.
When such customary and very fundamental principle of international law is mocked, trampled upon, and violated, no nation trusts the culprit, and so do we. Therefore, provision of verifiable and objective guarantees that the delicate balance of commitments will not be torpedoed anymore, the obligations will not be violated again, sanctions will not be reimposed under other pretexts or designations, as took place during the previous administration of the United States, and the JCPOA mechanism will not be abused, is absolutely necessary.
Takht-Ravanchi said Iran continues its remedial measures because other parties are not performing their obligations. He accused Washington of committing economic terrorism against Iran with actions that violate international law and the UN Charter. China's UN envoy also spoke at the meeting. He called for the removal of illegal and unilateral sanctions against Iran and said dialogue is the only path forward to resolve issues. The Russian envoy also weighed in on the ongoing talks in Vienna. He said the U.S. needs to show in action rather than words that it's willing to return to the compliance with the JCPOA. Well, Iran has held an exhibition of domestically made machinery and equipment dubbed Made in Iran. The expo seeks to support domestic producers in the wake of U.S. sanctions and prevent Iranian industries from accessing foreign technologies. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution is in its fifth decade. The revolution put an end to centuries of monarchy and established the Islamic Republic as the new political system in Iran. Now, as the country is preparing to mark the 42nd anniversary of the triumph of the revolution, military and state officials have gathered in Tehran to lay out the roadmap for the upcoming 40 years as part of a national plan called the Second Step of the Islamic Revolution.
From my point of view as a military commander, in the first 40 years of the revolution, Iran has taken greatest strides in the defense sector, moving from a mere consumer of foreign arms all the way to a producer of defense equipment. Now in the second phase of the revolution, we take it upon ourselves to turn into a military power by keeping abreast of the latest technologies.
2 years ago, and on the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, issued a statement titled The Second Phase, or The Second Step of the Islamic Revolution, which is viewed as the beginning of a new chapter in the life of the Islamic Republic.
The statement issued by the leader was a strategic roadmap not only for the Iranian nation, but for all freedom seekers in the world. It is a set of guidelines that instruct us to promote Islamic ideals across the globe. In my opinion, the most important part of it is the emphasis on science and technology. The leader urged us to excel in this arena, as science builds power, and this is what we have gathered here for.
The Islamic Revolution promised independence from world powers and freedom for Iranians. To this end, the country has tried to achieve self-sufficiency in different sectors. Military officials say, despite 4 decades of an all-out sanctions regime imposed by the U.S. on Iran's defense sector, the country has managed to indigenize its arms arsenal and build all the necessary military equipment needed to defend its sovereignty. The country has also managed to step in other key sectors, including space, nanotechnology, and medication.
Iranian officials say the Islamic Republic has fulfilled its promise of independence from the West and self-reliance on domestic capacities in the first phase of the revolution. They say it is now more resilient in the face of political and economic pressures and is ready to achieve higher goals in the second phase of the Islamic Revolution. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Fresh warnings from the European Union as tensions with Russia remain high over Ukraine. The bloc now says it's ready for some unprecedented action.
Our response to any further aggression may take the form of a robust scaling up and expansion of these existing sanctions. And of course, we are ready to take additional unprecedented measures with serious consequences for Russia.
Von der Leyen says the European Union has been working closely with the U.S. on options against Russia that go beyond the existing sanctions. Tensions over Ukraine have been escalating in the past week. Or weeks, that is. The West accuses Russia of preparing for a war on Ukraine. Russia instead blames Ukraine and its Western allies for escalating tensions. NATO has just stepped up its military presence near Russian borders, sending French warship to the Black Sea on Tuesday. UK's economy is in trouble. New data show that inflation there has reached its highest level in more than 10 years. According to the Office for National Statistics, the annual rate rose to 5.1% in November. The cost of factory products and the price of raw materials also jumped to their highest rate in 12 years. The coronavirus pandemic is taking part of the blame. The global fuel supply crunch and a jump in commodity prices are also pushing up inflation. The Bank of England will announce its latest monetary policy decision on Thursday. Central banks use interest rate hikes to try to damp high inflation. The United States hits a grim milestone in its fight against the COVID pandemic, with the number of deaths in the country now passing the 800,000 mark. The data from Johns Hopkins University represents the highest reported toll of any country in the world. Most deaths have been recorded among the unvaccinated and the elderly. The U.S. reached 50 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 2 days ago. The alarming surge in deaths comes as the world is bracing for a rise in cases of the new Omicron variant, with the World Health Organization warning that it's spreading at an unprecedented rate.
77 countries have now reported cases of Omicron, and the reality is that Omicron is probably in most countries, even if it hasn't been detected yet. Omicron is spreading at a rate we have not seen with any previous variant.
The WHO chief said many countries are rolling out their booster shots, warning of a repeat of vaccine hoarding and inequity. He noted that there are many people who have not received a single jab yet. Omicron was first detected in November. It has a large number of mutations. A preliminary study by South African scientists suggests Omicron is highly transmissible and may evade immunity from vaccination. The United Arab Emirates' reception of the Israeli Prime Minister has been met with anger. Palestinians say Abu Dhabi is betraying their cause by normalizing its relations with the regime. They're also calling for the expulsion of the UAE from the Arab League. Iran has also condemned the Israeli Prime Minister's visit to the UAE as detrimental to regional security.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has officially visited the United Arab Emirates, becoming the first sitting Israeli premier to visit the Persian Gulf country. On Monday, he met with senior UAE officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. In a joint statement, the two said they discussed several areas of cooperation, including trade, technology, the environment and tourism, as well as forming a joint research and development fund. Abu Dhabi and Tel Aviv established diplomatic relations last September under a U.S. brokered agreement. That deal also saw Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco normalize their ties with Israel. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement has strongly condemned the Emirati officials over receiving the Israeli Prime Minister, stressing that any normalization and alliance with the Tel Aviv regime amounts to betrayal of Palestine.
Well, you see, the monarch of the UAE, the royal family, are not really concerned about what's in the best interest of the region or of the Arab nation. They don't care about the people of the UAE, they don't care about the people of Palestine, and they don't care about the Arab, they certainly don't care about the Arab nation. So they're doing what they're doing because of how they perceive they will survive and prosper.
The trip has already drawn condemnation from the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It says the visit violates the Arab consensus that's supposed to support the Palestinian cause amid challenges imposed by Israel. Meanwhile, a member of the Palestinian Fatah Movement's Central Committee said the United Arab Emirates must be expelled from the Arab League due to normalization with Israel.
The UAE claims the normalization will enable it to mediate between the Israelis and the Palestinians, but that hasn't been helpful at all, considering Israel's 11-day deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip in May. Months after Tel Aviv normalized its ties with Abu Dhabi, Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians on an almost daily basis also raise questions about the real intentions behind the normalization.
The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia have recently appeared to have changed track in their foreign policies, making overtures to nations they had previously severed ties with. Last month, the Emirati foreign minister drew the ire of the United States by meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in capital Damascus. The UAE's senior national security advisor met his Iranian counterpart Ali Shamkhani and President Ibrahim Raisi in a rare visit to Iran earlier this month, a move that's said to have aimed at overcoming long-standing differences between the two sides.
They see the U.S. defeats in Afghanistan, a disorderly rout, actually. They see that the U.S. is going to have to pull out of Iraq. They see that the U.S. regime change operation has been defeated in Syria. Almost, and they see that the people of Yemen are defeating their staunch ally, Saudi Arabia. So they are like rats on a sinking ship, looking for a way to save themselves.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, however, will only lead to increased tensions as a result of the Zionist regime's Iranophobic policies. In the meantime, Iran's foreign ministry says people in West Asia have not forgotten the, quote, vicious and vindictive actions of Israel, describing the regime as a root cause of problems in the region.
So now all of this is U.S. policy, and it's going to continue to be U.S. policy. And that's why their vassal states in the Middle East, these Arab monarchies that have no no authority, really, to rule except by because of European colonialism and Western imperialism. They do what they're told.
Iran has repeatedly called for regional efforts to maintain stability and security, while warning that external elements can't bring peace to West Asia.
A volcano that's been spewing lava in the Canary island of La Palma for almost 3 months finally lulls, but scientists are warning there's no room for complacency. The local Volcanology Institute says, although seismic activities have stopped since Monday night, the eruption is not yet finished because it was followed by a surge in activity in previous times. The toxic fumes prompted fresh lockdowns in the island 2 days ago. La Palma's longest eruption on record has disrupted life for locals. It has destroyed almost 3,000 buildings and forced thousands of people to abandon their homes. It has also buried large areas of farmland. And that's a wrap for this edition of the World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Following the Holy Prophet in justice.
This is part of the speech delivered on October 24th, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
Even an enemy should be treated fairly. So this is another task, and this is primarily our responsibility. Whatever decision you make and whatever regulation you make, whether in the Islamic Consultative Assembly, where you pass laws, in the government, or in various other positions of management throughout the country, one of the most important things you take into account should be the issue of justice. You should think, is this in accordance with justice or not? Sometimes it is necessary to prepare an attachment describing justice for that regulation so that it becomes clear that this regulation and law is being implemented in accordance with justice. This is the second point. However, if we wish to observe justice, it should be noted that justice is not just about the distribution of property and wealth. Justice and fair treatment should be witnessed in everything.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
امروز توی فضای مجازی انسان گاهی اوقات بی‌عدالتی مشاهده میکنه. خلاف میگن، تهمت میزنن، دروغ میگن، قول به غیر علم میگن، اینا بی‌عدالتی است. اینا نباید انجام بگیره.
In the internet today, one sometimes witnesses injustices. They say untrue things, they slander, they lie, they promise without knowledge. These are acts of injustice and these things should not be done. A person who works with the internet needs to watch over himself. and those who control the internet need to be even more vigilant to ensure that such things do not happen. We should learn and get used to treating people fairly.
نظر شماست، ممکنه نظر درستی هم باشه، اما این رو با تهمت، با دروغ، با اهانت، با این چیزا نبایسته آلوده کرد.
Even when you speak, if you are not on good terms with someone and you do not share their viewpoint, it is all right. It is your opinion. It may be the right opinion, but it should not be contaminated with slander, lies, insults, and the like. It is very bad to contaminate one's viewpoint with these things. These statements were about justice.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
British High Court has overturned a ruling that prevented WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange from being extradited to the United States, ruling that he can be sent to the U.S. after Washington gave the court assurances that Assange's well-being would be protected were he extradited to the U.S. In January, the court rejected a previous extradition request on the grounds that moving Assange to the United States and isolating him would put him in danger of suicide. The 50-year-old Australian is wanted in the United States for disclosing confidential military and diplomatic records in 2010, which caused Washington great embarrassment. These documents included classified military and diplomatic information detailing U.S. bombing campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, information about civilian deaths and secret U.S. drone strikes in Yemen. In face of American officials' denial, he may face up to 175 years in jail if convicted. After being locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for 7 years, Assange was apprehended in 2019. He was not present in court, despite his denials of any wrongdoing. He has been held at London's high-security Belmarsh Prison for more than 2.5 years. During his High Court appeal in October, Assange had a stroke. The stress of the ongoing U.S. court case against him, as well as a general decline in his health as he approaches his third Christmas behind bars, is said to have precipitated the stroke. Advocates for press freedom have also voiced alarm over the verdict. Reporters Without Borders is concerned about the repercussions for journalism and press freedom throughout the world. RSF also urged Washington to finally drop its long-running case against the journalist.
The U.S. is basically extraterritorializing its laws. It's saying that even if you don't live in the United States, you don't work in the United States, you're not from the United States, if you publish documents the United States doesn't like, they will come get you. And, you know, you can be threatened with 175 years in jail. And they're trying to make an example out of him to scare other people. That's the point that they're making here. At the same time, I just argue one thing. Ironically, in a sense, although Assange's case is unique, it's not unique in terms of assurances, because the United States always does this. It always lies to other countries. It lies to other judges, to other jurisdictions, in order to get people into the U.S. And, you know, whether it's through the courts or by kidnapping and rendition, which we've seen the U.S. do a lot, they just kidnap people overseas and render them to they bring them to the United States. One way or another, they will find a way to get people in U.S. jurisdiction, because they know once you're there, no one is going to help you, no one is going to do anything. And that's the message they're sending here. It's that other countries need to stay in line. You need to hand over anyone we ask you to hand over. Whether it takes 10 years, 15 years, you're going to hand them over. And journalists should be scared of publishing documents the U.S. doesn't like.
It appears that the U.S. is attempting to use Assange as a fear tactic to ensure that comparable information concerning its misdeeds is not revealed again. According to Assange supporters, Washington has been discreetly manipulating events, only revealing itself when it filed an extradition request in 2019. According to them, there were several indications that the U.S. was pursuing vengeance on Assange rather than justice. The U.S.'s claims may have far-reaching ramifications for journalism's future and its capacity to hold governments accountable. The U.S. certainly wants to make sure that such a leak would not happen again. The English courts have now sparked outrage by seemingly giving permission to political persecution. Critics fear that the precedent would mean that any journalist in the UK or other parts of the world may now be brought to the US for punishment if they cause Washington sufficient embarrassment.
I think that the US is using its judicial overreach as a way to intimidate people, including journalists, including diplomats, including economic leaders of countries which are not in their favor.
The issue is that if Assange can be imprisoned for performing journalism, why can't the editors of other papers? This is undoubtedly a significant setback for journalistic freedom. On Friday, a bipartisan group of leading members of the U.S. House Committee on Foreign Affairs passed a bill aimed at restricting Iran's defensive military prowess. The Stop Iranian Drones Act would ban the supply, sale, or transfer of military drones to or from Iran under U.S. law. The bill addresses what the U.S. claims to be the growing threat of Iran's unmanned aerial vehicle program. However, despite gaining self-sufficiency in the arms industry by making great progress in developing and manufacturing a broad range of military equipment in recent years, Iran has time and again proven that its military capabilities are purely defensive in the face of moves by the U.S. and its regional allies, which have been fomenting chaos and tension in the region. Like last month, when the Iranian army intercepted two U.S. unmanned aerial vehicles that had penetrated the country's airspace, giving them a stern warning to stay away from the zone where it was holding massive drills. The ban imposed on the Iranian military drones comes amid ongoing talks over the removal of anti-Iran sanctions between Tehran and the signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. The U.S. has for long tried to tie Iran's military capabilities to the talks. However, the Islamic Republic has repeatedly underscored that its defensive capabilities will be never subject to negotiations. The U.S. also baselessly accuses Iran of conducting drone attacks in West Asia, while Washington has blood on its hands for killing thousands of innocent civilians by conducting drone and airstrikes in the region. Also, let's not forget that the United States is the leading exporter of arms in the world. Washington attempts to restrict Iran's defensive capabilities while it sells bombs, drones, and arms to other countries like Saudi Arabia that use them in unjust wars like the one in Yemen to kill innocent civilians. In fact, half of U.S. arms transfers between 2016 and 2020 went to West Asia region, particularly Saudi Arabia, leading to more instability and chaos. The U.S. is also guilty of civilian killings in many war theaters, like in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, from drone strikes to other military action. Rights groups have accused Washington of hiding the real number of civilian casualties and underreporting them. Based on the U.S. military's own assertion, Washington has conducted almost 100,000 drone and air strikes in the West Asia region in the past 20 years, according to a new analysis published by the civilian harm monitoring group Air Wars. The U.S. strikes have killed at least 22,000 civilians across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan since 2001. The group says the number could probably be as high as 48,000. The U.S. also assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes in a drone strike near the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. The two were iconic figures in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. That's while top U.S. diplomats have previously admitted that Washington is responsible for the foundation of the Daesh terrorist group. Days after the Brazen Act, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launched a volley of missiles at a major military base housing American forces in Iraq. Iran denounced the assassination as a state terrorism and vowed to end the American presence in the region as the ultimate act of revenge.
Well, clearly, if one was going to have a completely honest and neutral legal international legal system, no country can stand above it. But we don't have that. And in fact, we have a system where the people who've got the arms and the money make the decisions. So obviously, if we were to say that any time a country used a drone and killed other civilians, there was going to be sanctions, clearly those countries that have drones, in particular this country, would have to be sanctioned. But that's simply not going to happen.
The political dynamics in West Asia have been undergoing an overhaul since earlier this year, when U.S. President Joe Biden announced his country will withdraw its troops from Afghanistan following 20 years of war, and Washington's Western allies followed suit. Just this week, U.S.-led forces ended their combat mission in Iraq, switching to advisory roles in the country. The departure of foreign troops comes amid growing anti-West sentiments in the region and a shift in the focus of Washington's foreign policy from West Asia to China and Russia. That has brought the regional countries together to address the challenges facing the region. One instance is Qatar, which had been under a blockade by Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates since June 2017. That went on until January this year, when the quartet agreed to end the diplomatic row. In the meantime, Saudi Arabia and Egypt have appointed new ambassadors to Qatar. Trade and travel links have also been re-established with Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Egypt, but not with Bahrain.
He has noticed that this American support is limited to just maintaining Saudi Arabia as an outpost of military, of U.S. imperial projection and power play in the region. And of course, when this U.S. support were to be removed or to be reduced, Saudi Arabia, as well as the UAE, as well as Bahrain, as Qatar, and Kuwait, they need more pillars to work with. They need more legs to stand on. And one of the best things to do in this region is collaborate and cooperate with the governments that already exist and try to bridge the differences that might exist between various countries.
Qatar's emir has traveled to Saudi Arabia and met Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman several times since then. On Wednesday, bin Salman made his first official visit to Qatar since he was named Crown Prince in 2017. A senior official at the Iranian Foreign Ministry says the development of ties and cooperation with the neighboring countries is among the priorities of the new administration in Tehran. Alireza Inayati says trips and negotiations by the Iranian officials in recent months are all proof of that policy. He says Iran has good ties with the Persian Gulf Arab states, including the UAE, Oman, and Kuwait. Inayati heads the Iranian Foreign Ministry's Office for Persian Gulf Affairs. He was speaking with the Iranian Arabic news channel Al Alam. Inayati also said Iran and Saudi Arabia have held four rounds of talks since September to mend their ties and plan more negotiations. He cited progress in the talks, saying they were friendly and constructive. Ties severed between Tehran and Riyadh in 2016. The two have differences on some regional issues, including the Yemen war. For years, the kingdom pursued a confrontational foreign policy toward the Islamic Republic, but it has recently appeared to have changed track.
When it comes down to it, they are two nations that border the Arab Gulf. They're two nations that are in a very strategic area, who border the Gulf region, border the Persian Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz. So these all areas that are of a vitally strategic importance. And when push comes to shove, it is them who have to live there, not the United States, not the United Kingdom or the European Union or any of these Western powers. It is the Iranians, it is the Arabs, the Saudis, the Iraqis, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris who have to live in this region, have to find a way to keep on living. This is something that I believe a couple of years ago that the Iranian government already said, and when it comes down to it, this should be a regional decision.
The recent developments in the region signal a paradigm shift in the ties between West Asian countries. The jury is still out on what that would mean for the United States' interests and influence in the region.
Germany has a new chancellor. Social Democrat Olaf Scholz has been sworn in as Germany's new chancellor, ending 16 years of conservative rule under Angela Merkel. Scholz, who is now 63, had served as vice chancellor and finance minister in Merkel's outgoing government. He got 395 votes from lawmakers in the lower house of parliament. Scholz will oversee a liberal-left coalition government between the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, the Greens, and the Liberal Free Democratic Party, or the FDP. This is the first power-sharing agreement of such a kind in Germany, and the first governing alliance with three parties since 1957. Merkel's final days as chancellor was her 5,860th day in office, falling short of the record set by her late former mentor, Helmut Kohl, by a mere 10 days.
Well, the positive is that she actually kept the German economy strong. Germany is still an export powerhouse. There are signs of a certain weakening, but still its position is very strong. She left very popular, which is very important. Clearly, Germans liked her steady, somewhat conservative leadership, and she certainly established Germany as the preeminent power in the European Union.
The alliance brings to a close 16 years of rule by Angela Merkel, who chose not to run again. Germany's incoming government has agreed that EU authorities should act more urgently to defend the rule of law, including withholding EU funds if necessary.
I mean, the pressures that are pulling apart the EU are growing. After Brexit, people became frightened and decided, that maybe leaving the EU was not such a great idea. But now these centrifugal forces are reasserting themselves. The EU is torn between East and West, North and South, but the East European countries are pushing a much more confrontational policy vis-a-vis Russia. They're allying themselves with the United States, and France and Germany are caught in the middle. And they're kind of trapped, and they aren't sure what to do.
The new government has ambitious plans to fight climate change by phasing out coal early and focusing on renewable energy, but their initial priority will be tackling the coronavirus pandemic. Angela Merkel served alongside four U.S. presidents, four French presidents, five British prime ministers, and eight Italian premiers. Her chancellorship was marked by four major challenges: the global financial crisis, Europe's debt crisis, the 2015-16 influx of refugees to Europe, and the coronavirus pandemic. While credited with securing huge European bailouts that saved Greece from crashing out of the Eurozone, it was achieved at a heavy social cost. Merkel was highly unpopular for being the driving force behind bailouts and austerity cuts. The policy made millions of people jobless, plunging them into poverty. Merkel also kept Germany's borders open to hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing the wars in Syria and Iraq. But the policy drew criticism from right-wing politicians. The refugee influx gave a good excuse to far-right groups to fan the flames of Islamophobia. Popular anger also sent the far-right bloc, the anti-immigration AfD, to parliament in 2017 for the first time since World War II, making it the biggest opposition force. Merkel's government was accused of protecting Germany's vital automobile industry by watering down emissions regulation reforms, and its refusal to advance the 2038 deadline to quit coal energy also irking green activists.
And she's been caught in the middle of a lot of conflicts and has acquitted herself especially well. And that includes the Ukraine and Iran, especially the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear accord. And there, Germany under Merkel mostly towed the U.S. line and did not get very many rewards for it. They lost business opportunities in Iran, and they have been kind of chained to an increasingly erratic U.S. policy.
Her government also did not play a constructive role after the nuclear deal with Iran in 2015. Germany under Merkel practically followed the maximum pressure campaign of the U.S. against Iran and did not fulfill its obligations under the deal.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim and welcome. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam Musa al-Kadhim was the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim was the son of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, when we talk about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we see historically that he left an amazing legacy full of goodness, righteousness, beauty, and he was a brilliant guide for the community in general. And among the unique aspects that marked Imam al-Kadhim's personality is his steadfastness and determination, his perseverance in front of the difficult events and the ordeals showered upon him by his contemporary tyrants. Old and young have an amazing opportunity to learn to how to deal with life's difficulties by looking into the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام الضعيف من لم يرفع إليه حجة ولم يعرف الاختلاف فإذا عرف الاختلاف فليس بضعيف.
Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam stated
The weak person is one whom the divine proof has not reached, and who would not be able to differentiate, even if it did reach him. If he is able to differentiate between truth and falsehood, therefore, then he is not considered weak.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, when we're talking about the different dialogues and the conversations of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, the seventh divinely appointed Imam, we find that when he was a very young boy, an interesting incident occurred. So Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was at this time at the house of his father, the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now the esteemed Abu Hanifa, who of course is the founder of the largest sect of Sunni Muslims, Abu Hanifa happened to come and want to ask a question from Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam. So while Abu Hanifa was sitting there waiting for the sixth Imam to come, a young boy came out walking slowly. Abu Hanifa asked the boy, "Where does the stranger relieve nature?" The boy turned to Abu Hanifa and said to him, "Slowly." Then this young boy sat down politely, leaned against the wall, and began to give Abu Hanifa the answer to his question. The young boy said, "Avoid the banks of rivers, avoid the places where fruits fall, avoid the courtyards of mosques, and avoid the middle of the road. Hide yourself behind a wall. And you should not face the Qibla, nor should you have your back towards the Qibla. And finally, relieve nature where you can." The boy explained to Abu Hanifa the various places where it was detested or forbidden to relieve nature. So eventually Abu Hanifa, this scholar of the Ahlul Sunnah brothers, was dazzled and astonished because he had not thought that there was a boy of such young age who had great scientific and religious abilities. So Abu Hanifa asked, "What is your name?" The reply was, "Musa ibn Ja'far ibn Muhammad ibn Ali ibn al-Husayn ibn Ali ibn Abi Talib al-Kadhim alayhi salam." And so, dear friends, the Ahlul Bayt of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, of course, are endowed with this special religious knowledge, this special wisdom, and this special scientific ability. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij. This is the door or the gate through which your prayers will be accepted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Your hajat, hawa'ij, your hajat will be responded to by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala if you take your hajat through this gate. And this is not only limited to the Shias. You know, we have a historian who lived in the 4th century by the name of Al-Khatib al-Baghdadi. And one of his famous books, actually, he's from Baghdad itself. And in his book, Tariq Baghdad, in the very first volume, he talks about the 7th Imam and he quotes a statement from Abu Ali al-Khilal, a Sunni Hanbali scholar. And this is, you know, before the 4th century. And he says that this Hanbali scholar used to say, مَا حَمَّنِ أَمْرٌ فَقَسَدْتُ قَبْرَ مُوسَى بِنْ جَعْفَرْ فَتَوَسَّلْتُ بِهِ. He says, whenever I had issues and problems, I used to go to the grave of Musa bin Ja'far, فَتَوَسَّلْتُ بِهِ. And I used to seek tawassul, intercession through him, إِلَّا وَصَحَّلَ اللَّهُ تَعَالَ لِي مَا أُحِبُّ. And whenever this happened, when I went through him, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala facilitated my hajat and my desire.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. أنت يا بدر المدينة خير خلق الله يا من قد جئت فينا بالهدى والحب دينا أنت يا بدر المدينة خير خلق الله
10 minutes.
When it comes to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, people usually talk about the crimes the regime has committed in this land. But Israel couldn't destroy the Palestinian people's homeland if it didn't have the support of Britain. The sad story of the occupation and its concomitant sufferings dates back to over 100 years ago. In 1916, once Britain's Prime Minister, then the Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, promised Palestine to the Jewish community in Britain. Then, on November 2, 1917, he made it official in the form of a letter addressed to the leader of the Jewish community and a member of the Zionist movement in Britain, Walter Rothschild. At the time, Britain was not even in control of Palestine, as it was still part of the Ottoman Empire. Either way, Palestine was never Balfour's to transfer so casually to anyone else. The letter, known as the Balfour Declaration, marked the beginning of the occupation of Palestine.
A group of Zionists met in London in 1917 on July the 17th to draft the formula for a declaration to be made by the British government that would, in fact, provide the underpinnings and the justification for Jewish immigration to Palestine and the creation of a national homeland. And so on July 17th, the Zionist organization completed work that they'd been working on for a long time and drafted a declaration which was to be forwarded on to the British government. The British government then spent 4 or 5 months debating the formula for the declaration, slightly adjusted it, and issued it at the beginning of November in 1917.
When the intentions of the British and their rapport with the Zionists became too apparent, Palestinians started to protest, a kind that has never ceased, over a century later. The reason is, of course, too apparent, since the horrific consequences of British colonialism and the eventual complete Zionist takeover of Palestine are still felt after all these years. Paltry attempts to pacify Palestinian anger were to no avail, especially after the League of Nations Council in July 1922 approved the terms of the British Mandate for Palestine. It came without consulting the Palestinians, who would disappear from the British and international radar only to reappear as negligible rioters, troublemakers, and obstacles to the joint British-Zionist colonial concoctions. Despite occasional assurances, the British intention of ensuring the establishment of an exclusively Jewish state in Palestine was becoming clearer with time. The Balfour Declaration was hardly an aberration, but had indeed set the stage for the full-scale ethnic cleansing that followed decades later.
We are here in the neighborhood, the Palestinian neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in occupied East Jerusalem. We come here every week and to say no to the occupation, no to apartheid, no to ethnic cleansing. The Israeli government is planning to deport the indigenous people, Palestinian people, from their home in order to evacuate it for settlers, for Jewish settlers, for colonialists.
After World War II, the UK appeared as less influential in the international arena compared to what it used to be. However, it continued to support Israel in every possible way. In November 1967, after the Six-Day War, Britain co-authored the UN Resolution 242, which could have led to a full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. However, it did very little to insist on its implementation as a permanent member of the UN Security Council. While many might argue that Britain has been more vocal towards Israeli crimes against Palestinians, London has taken no real action to condemn Israel for the crimes it commits in the occupied territories. For example, Britain could have issued a symbolic apology in 2017 on the centenary of the Balfour Declaration. It could have been a moment of reckoning for Britain, but it was not. Instead, the government of then Prime Minister Theresa May celebrated the occasion with Israeli authorities. In the meantime, the British government continues to advocate for the so-called two-state solution, a Palestinian state side by side with Israel. But in reality, it's only protecting the interests of the Israelis.
Mr. Deputy Speaker, 3 years ago, on the 9th of November 2011, the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Member for Richmondshire, then Foreign Secretary, told this House, and I quote, "The United Kingdom judges that the Palestinian Authority largely fulfills criteria for United Nations membership, including statehood." And he added, and again I quote, "We reserve the right, we the United Kingdom, reserve the right to recognise a Palestinian state bilaterally at a moment of our choosing and when it can best help bring about peace." Mr. Deputy Speaker, that moment is now. I urge honourable members on all sides to support this amendment.
What we want is to see an Israel that is at peace with its neighbours, and I should remind you that the policy of our government is for a two-state solution, which is what we want to achieve and hope to help to bring about in a modest and humble way.
In fact, every time Palestine was getting close to claiming its rights, the UK came forward and stalled the process. When asked for clarification on the question of Palestinian statehood, then UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab sent a letter to the Balfour Project reiterating an old position. The British government will recognize a Palestinian state at a time when it best serves the objective of peace.
Well, I'm looking forward to meeting leaders on all sides in Israel, in the Palestinian territories, President Abbas, obviously Prime Minister Netanyahu, Foreign Minister Ashkenazi. And look, I'm here because we are a strong friend of Israel, but we also feel very strongly that we want to see a peaceful two-state solution.